Hello everyone, this is NQF staff and we'll just be starting shortly. I think a lot of people are just dialing in now, so we'll start in 1 to 2 minutes. Good afternoon, everyone. This is May from the National Quality Forum, and we'll be starting our Subgroup 3 Scientific Methods Panel conference call today. And I'll just start out, if people are still dialing in, I'll start out with just quick housekeeping remarks, and then I'll turn it over to Ashley Wilbon, who is our Senior Director, to perform roll call and DOI. So just to let everyone know, the discussion guide was actually sent to subgroup members yesterday. This document will guide us in our measure discussions today, and we will follow it with the order presented on the document. Consensus was not reached for 4 measures presented on the discussion guide and are subsequently slated for discussion today. All other measures will not be discussed during today's call unless a member of the subgroup would like to pull that measure. If you choose not to discuss additional measures, the decisions from your preliminary analyses will be made final. In that same email, with the discussion guide, there was a link to a SurveyMonkey. So we asked the subgroup members to pull that survey up now and cast your votes on reliability and or validity at the conclusion of each measure discussion. Staff will prompt you to cast your votes when the timing is appropriate. Timing today is limited to roughly 30 minutes to discuss each measure. Although we would like to come to a consensus on all 4 measures today, we do have a follow-up meeting scheduled on Tuesday, March 19th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time to discuss any outstanding items. Finally, I would like to note that this is a public call. Developer representatives may be on the line to answer questions from staff or from panel members. However, there will be no opportunity for public comment. For record keeping purposes, we ask that you please say your name each time you provide remarks. And now I'll turn it over to Ashley to perform roll call and DOI. Ashley?
Thanks, May. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us. So I'm going to combine the disclosure of interest with our roll call for today for the methods panel members. So just bear with me as we make it through all of the preamble that goes with that. So you received a disclosure of interest form from us before when you were named to the committee, and then we send one every year, kind of an overall disclosure of interest, and then we also send a more specific, measure-specific disclosure of interest form that asks you about the specific measures you're going to be reviewing and whether or not you have any relationship to the measures that are specifically under review or any related or competing measures that we may have identified. So between these two forms, we do ask you quite, you know, a lot of questions in terms of your degree of involvement with the measures under review. So in the interest of transparency, we do ask on calls that we review measures to have those review measures to orally disclose any interest or conflict of interest they may have. So today we're going to ask you, like I said, to orally disclose any information that you believe is relevant to this committee, specifically the measures you reviewed as a member of this subgroup, and any related or competing measures. So we don't need necessarily some of your resume, only any particular activities, research grants, consulting, paid or unpaid activities related to measure development for the measures that are specifically under review. So this group reviewed 10 measures this cycle. There were two readmissions measures, one for facility 7-day risk standardized hospital visit rate for outpatient colonoscopy, and another for hospital-wide 30-day all-cause unplanned readmission. And then there were 8 cost measures around various conditions for PCI, lower extremity, chronic critical limb ischemia, pneumonia, cataract removal, colonoscopy, knee arthroplasty, pneumonia, if I didn't already mention that. So several measures that you reviewed, and a couple reminders as well before we get into the roll call. You sit on this group as an individual. You don't represent the interests of your employer or anyone that may have nominated you. And just because you disclose does not mean you have a conflict. Again, we just do this in the spirit of openness and transparency. So we'll go ahead and get started. I'll call your name. Please let us know if you're here and if you have any disclosures of interest. Karen Joint Maddox.
Present. Sorry, in the middle of a sneeze.
Thank you.
I do not have any direct disclosures. I do contract work for the for HHS with the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation. So I interact with CMS and Acumen and folks like that through that work, but nothing related to these measures.
Thank you. Jennifer Perloff?
Oh, sorry, same problem. Hi, I'm here, and I do want to make sure I'm clear. My research work is involved developing an episode grouper for Medicare. Acumen was our evaluation contractor during that work, but I was not involved in any way, shape, or form in the development of these specific measures, but I'm sort of intimately familiar with this space.
Thank you, Jen. Ron Walters? Are you there, Ron? Are you on mute? Okay. Christy Teaglin?
Yes, I'm here, and I do not have anything to disclose.
Okay, thank you. Jack Needleman?
Yes, I'm here. No disclosures.
Okay, thanks, Jack. Susan White?
Yep, I'm here. No disclosures.
Hi, thanks, Susan. I'm just going to go back to Ron. Ron, are you there?
I'm here now. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm in clinic.
Ron,
that's
welcome.
Why. Had to run out of the room. Yep.
Okay. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Do you have any disclosures to share?
I have no disclosures to share.
Okay. Thank you, Ron.
Okay.
So, again, thank you, everyone, for disclosing and letting us know that you're here. If at any point during the discussion you feel that anyone is speaking or acting in a biased manner, please let us know. You can email us as staff, we will do our best to address any concerns that may arise. Are there any questions based on the disclosures that were made today? Okay, great. So today, as May mentioned, we have 4 measures that are slated for review. Measure 2539, which is one of the a hospital-based visit rate for outpatient colonoscopy, and then 3 of the cost measures, one for elective PCI, revascularization, and pneumonia. There were 4 measures that passed based on the preliminary evaluations that were submitted by methods panel members. These measures are not slated for review on this call unless someone from the methods panel decides that would like to suggest that they are pulled for discussion. Those measures are 3495, which is the hospital-wide 30-day all-cause unplanned readmission, 3509, which is the cataract removal with intraocular lens implantation, was a cost measure, the screening and surveillance colonoscopy cost measure, and the knee arthroplasty cost measure. There were also two measures that did not pass the initial preliminary analysis by methods panel members. That was 3514, the intracranial hemorrhage or cerebral infarction measure, and 3515, ST elevation or STEMI with PCI. So, again, I just want to make sure to that everyone was oriented with what we're going to be discussing, and also to give the methods panel subgroup an opportunity to call out any measures in addition to what we have already slated for discussion. Are there any requests for other measures to be pulled for discussion?
This is Ron. Could I just ask a question?
Sure.
This is going to be a general question, okay, not specifically a measure oriented. With so many measures that fell basically under the same category of cost and efficiency, many of which were done by the very similar, if not the same, methodology, okay? So it was almost a templated methodology for certain some of them. Could I hear some feedback about what people noticed or what their major contentions were about the ones that did not pass versus the ones that did within the cost and efficiency group? Was it the quality of the analysis? Was it the type of analysis, et cetera?
Right. Ron, can I hold that question for just a second? Because I was actually going to get to that in just a second, and we can talk about kind of the best way to go about evaluating those measures, because you're right, there are a lot of kind of the underpinnings and the construction of those measures and the testing approaches were very similar. So there are nuances with each of those conditions where, you know, some of the testing results, even though they applied the same method, the results were different. So, you know, but we do have a couple options for how we can go about evaluating those and talking about them. We can do kind of an overarching discussion and then dive into each measure individually. So we'll come back to that in just a second. And I think we'll have a discussion as a group about the best way to go about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for bringing that up. I did also just want to point out that this call is the first since we've started the subgroup calls with methods panel members that we're inviting developers to answer questions and be available to methods panel members to respond to, you know, any concerns that come up during the discussion. So I did want to just take this opportunity to check in to make sure that the developers for these measures that will be under review today are on the phone from the developers from Yale and Acumen.
Hi,
you guys there?
Liz Stride at Yale.
Okay.
Our team is on the phone.
Hi, Liz.
Hi.
What about Acumen? Is there someone?
Yeah, this is Sri Nagavarapu from Acumen. We have a team on the phone.
Okay. I'm sorry. Can you say your first name again, please?
Sure. Sri, just S-R-I.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you guys very much. I also just wanted to point out a quick process point for the cost measures. We are going to discuss the colonoscopy outpatient measure first, but just as a quick point of process as we make it through, the evaluation process for the cost measures is slightly different than some of our other committees. Mainly because actually very much like the readmissions committee, the cost committee is not a clinically based committee. The experts that are comprised on that standing committee are there are some physicians who obviously are clinical experts, but there are also a lot of economists, methodologists, and other backgrounds and expertise on that committee. And so oftentimes when we do get clinically focused episode-based measures, cost measures for review, we do employ the help of clinical expert tests that are convened to provide the standing committee with clinical guidance as well on the clinical aspects of the measures. So for those measures, in addition to the methodological input that we get from the methods panel, we will also be convening various clinical tests to review the clinical aspects of those measures. So those tests have already been convened and are in place. And so regardless of the results of the methods panel results of the voting, all of the measures will still go forward to the technical expert panels. So all measures of those measures will still get the clinical input. And based on whether or not they pass the methods panel results or not, we will then determine which measures go forward to the committee. So I just kind of wanted to point that out as some kind of a nuance to our process with these particular measures. And it will be, as we begin to receive more of these episode-based measures, it will be a process that we'll probably continue to use in order to make sure that we get the adequate expertise and input on these measures as they make it through the process. So I just wanted to make sure that folks were aware of that and as measures kind of make it through the process.
Can I just quick question
sure.
on that? So this is
sure.
Jen.
Mm-hmm.
So what the implication of that is that the clinical specifics of the measure should not be as much of our concern here today, that there will be someone paying attention to some of those clinical details.
Yes, and
okay.
Certainly to the extent that you have that expertise or you have concerns, we certainly will, you know, document those and include those as part of the feedback. But there are clinical experts as well. So if you're, maybe not as comfortable about some of the or have, maybe your expertise is not in the clinical space, you know, you can rest that there will be clinical experts that we'll be looking at them as well.
Excellent. Okay, thanks.
Yes. So with that, why don't we go ahead and jump into 2539. And then we'll have some discussion about the cost measures when we start that group of measures. Okay, so for 2539, again, it was one of the measures that where consensus was not reached. It passed validity with a moderate score. Reliability was the criterion where the consensus was not reached. I did want to bring a few things to your attention as we dive in. So this measure was reviewed by the methods panel in the fall cycle. The fall cycle was the first submission of the measure since it was previously endorsed. So this is the first maintenance review, if you will. So it is a maintenance measure. I won't rehash all of the details in terms of the specs about the measure. You have that in front of you. But I did just want to highlight a few things before we dive into the discussion and kind of highlight some of the things that I think should be a focus of discussion by the methods panel. So I'm going to kind of skip down straight into reliability and validity. So with reliability, we ended up with one high score, two moderates, two low, and one insufficient, which left us in that consensus not reached zone. For their reliability testing, they submitted signal-to-noise testing for the measure score. They presented data for based on two samples of data, one for 3 years of data, another for 1 year of data, and the results for those are here in the discussion guide. For the 3 years of data, the median score was 0.814 for the hospital outpatient departments, and then 0.893 for the ASCs, and then for 1 year of data, the median reliability was 0.593, and then 0.735 for ASCs. So for this particular criterion, there was concern over the reliability testing results, particularly for the 1 year, for the results presented for 1 year of data, and also a note that the measure is reported using a single year of data. And so, obviously, I think the discussion is going to be there. I just want to just point out that for the last submission to the methods panel, the measure passed reliability but not validity. So we have a bit of a flip of the results for this particular evaluation. So I just want to make sure that folks are kind of understand potentially the differences between this submission that they submitted last cycle and for this cycle. And so from what we can tell so far, and we may just want to check in with the developers, the difference in what they submitted last cycle and this cycle is last cycle they also submitted split path testing results. So that was not included in this submission. And just to point out, I know that one of the reviewers had kind of questioned why that testing was not submitted. And NQS, we don't have any requirements on submitting both signal to noise and split path or either or. Signal to noise is an acceptable method of reliability testing that we do accept. And so we just wanted to make sure that the voting wasn't reflective of them not having submitted the split half testing, because that's not necessarily a requirement. The evaluation should be based on what they have submitted, which is the signal to noise of analysis. So with that, why don't I just pause there, see if there are any questions, and maybe open it up for discussion for the panel for that element.
This is Jack Needleman, and I think one of the themes that's going to be all through today's discussions is whether the characterization of reliability that has been presented and that often is cited in the literature are in fact the standards we want to apply for levels of reliability for purpose of use. And I will just say that in general, I find the standards from the literature, when we look at the actual implications for classification, those standards tend to be lower than the ones I would apply in terms of the standards for liability, and that's going to run through all of my discussion today. But I think for the committee, in general, thinking through that issue and getting some committee-based standards for where we think the standards of reliability or correlation or stability of rankings is going to be one of the issues that the committee is going to have to confront as a committee, separate and apart from the review of individual measures.
This is Susan White. I had an issue. My reliability issue was actually beyond that, and was in the way that they sort of projected the three-year. They used 1 year of data to calculate the reliability and then projected it to what it would be with 3 years of reliability. And I think that assumes that there's a big assumption around the stability of the measure throughout the years that was what sort of made me pause on whether the reliability was acceptable or not. Not even looking at the level of the score, but just the way the methodology and the way they applied it.
And this is Ron. Susan, that's exactly what I wrote in my assessment also. And in fact, probably the only reason that I called it low reliability rather than moderate was exactly that assumption and the way the calculation was done, 3 years versus 1 year.
This is Jenna. I think I confess that I somewhat ignored the 3 years because it's a 1 year measure, and it seemed like the 1 year results were the ones that mattered. So I was more in Jack's camp around sort of the absolute value of the reliability statistic.
Yeah, and this is Jack again. You know, if the measure is going to be based upon 1 year of data, then the 3 year reliability You know, the question I asked in mine was, is this going to be based upon 3 years of pool data? Is it going to be based upon one? If it's one, then the 3 year figure is irrelevant. But I appreciate if it is, you know, if it's 3 actual years, you know, that's not specified here. So if it's actually a 1 year.
Hi, this is Craig Krasinski at Yale Core. I was wondering if we could clarify.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Sure. So first of all, to address the split half reliability calculation, we did include that in our original submission, and that's what you're referencing. We did decide to pull that, and I think that was exactly for the reasons that you're suggesting, that we have to project that data because we at the time did not have what would require 6 full years of data to do a 3 year split sample reliability. We were able to acquire 3 years of data to do the signal to noise, and that's what was submitted with this submission. In terms of what is going to be used for public reporting, CMS has recently released in their regulation that they will be using a 3 year data period, which is also partly the reason why we submitted the additional 3 years for signal to noise.
So this is Ashley from NQF. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name of the developer from Yale that was speaking, but
It's Craig Parzynski.
Craig, thank you. I just want to clarify. So the specifications that you submitted for the measure, do they also reflect that the measure is reported and aggregated over 3 years?
The specifications, I believe, that were submitted likely reflect mostly 1 year of data. And 3 years of data, we may not have been able to run everything at that stage when we were trying to meet the submission deadline.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually, this is going to this. I think we're talking both about data and specifications. We could formally specify this as 3 years. CMS was pushing that decision through rulemaking and finalizing while we were giving you stuff. So the timing is just not completely aligned, which I'm sorry, it makes it confusing. But it is finalized in rulemaking for 3 years of data for reporting. And so the measure could be, I'm raising a question because it's really CMS's decision. I'm not sure if they're on the line, but the measure could be formally, you know, evaluated for reendorsement with 3 years of data. If that's part of what you want to see specified as the quote-unquote specification.
Yeah, I think the concern is that, you know, we want to make sure that the testing, you know, if you've done testing to demonstrate that the measures are reliable at a certain kind of sample size or data, we need that to also, you know, the testing should reflect the specifications. And so those need to align. What we don't kind of want is decisions made for recommending based on 1 year of data and then the measure gets used another way or vice versa. And so to the extent that, you know, any decisions that we make, it just needs to be consistent that, you know, voting on reliability, for example, we're voting based on the results for 3 years and that the specifications will be, you know, aligned to support that as well. So,
And can I ask a question? This is just to go to what you're voting on or how you're – so in a different data set with a different – I mean, if you're specifying – if you're evaluating for use in these populations for these facilities, HO hospital outpatient departments and ASCs, if the endorsement is specific to those settings, it absolutely will be in 3 years of data. If you're saying, could this measure be used in a different setting, then you might need 5 years of data or 1 year of data. It would depend on the outcome rate and the variation and all those things, because you would have different statistics, you know, reliability when you ran the test. So I guess could you share
do you need them? If this committee is looking at it, because it's re-endorsement, for this use in these settings, the assumption should be, because it's finalized in regulation, 3 years of data.
Okay.
The testing wasn't on 3 years of data, though, right? It was on one?
The reliability data is in 3 years of data, and the reason that that was available is because we performed that analysis for the regulation writing, and we were unable to kind of run it in all the results in the 3 years of data. I would argue that 1 year of data does have sufficient reliability too, however, much of the literature that's out there suggests that a value of 0.59 or higher is in the moderate to high range, so I don't think it should be a major sticking point, but I did want to be able to clarify why the 3 years was in there and try to hold up any prolonged conversation questioning whether or not it was in regulation or not.
So this is Ashley again. I just want to make sure I understand Liz's question, and then I'll turn it back over to the methods panel. So the description of the measures specifically also points out the hospital outpatient department and the surgical center, but what you're saying is that the measure could be used for other settings? I guess I just want to clarify for my own understanding.
Yeah, I mean, it's embarrassing, and I apologize that I don't know that. Given how much I know about NQF and how involved I've been, but I'm just saying, whenever you endorse a measure, right, it gets endorsed with a particular data set. So you're endorsing the measure in that context. Right. I mean, once it's endorsed, people use it. People may use it in other ways, and they may adapt it and apply back to. I just don't know how tight that endorsement is. Oh, we meant for this setting only, right? But I would just say that I don't want to hang up the committee on this at all. For this use, it's 3 years of data that's finalized in rulemaking. Very recently.
And I would say yes, that the endorsement does should match the setting. I mean, the specifications and the measures we endorse, it should match the kind of the level of it's endorsed based on how the measure is specified. So for the settings, the level of analysis, the measurement period, all of those things are baked in with the measure. Now, what you're referring to and how people kind of take the measure and apply it in different settings, that's something that, kind of out of our hands to a large extent. So I would just say, the committee or the panel and the committee is going to be looking at the measure as specified and kind of what happens after, it's endorsed potentially. That's, we don't have a lot of control. All we can say is this is how the measure, we endorse the measure for use in these specific conditions based on the specification. So, with that, I'll just kind of hand it back over to the methods panel to see if there's any other clarifying questions about the 3 years versus the 1 year.
This is Jen. I would just say I think it's a point that I appreciate that you may expand or contract the time that you collect the measure across, and it's so in different situations you may need to add more years of data. How that gets reflected in the form and whether developers should show us 1, 2, 3, 5 multiple years so we can understand the boundaries of that, I just want to acknowledge that that's an important point. I appreciate that. So here we have 1 and 3, and that gives us the contours of that. But the measure has to be sort of endorsed for a specific time or range of time, maybe multiple times.
Right. We wouldn't.
And here, I just want to clarify, Elizabeth, again. Yes. What CMS is, so there was, this is just a timing thing, but then what we would really like NQF to focus its review on is a 3-year time frame. That's the re-endorsement that is most relevant to the current use of the measure.
So this is Ashley. That said, I think it was Susan that had initially pointed out some concerns about the way that the analysis for the 3 years of data is done. Is that, have those concerns been addressed, or is that?
So this is Susan. I think some of my colleagues convinced me that it might not have been relevant since we had 1 year, but now I think it is relevant since we're supposed to be evaluating on 3 years, although I might be confused. So.
No, I think that's an accurate characterization, Susan. I think based on what the developers have shared now about how the measure will actually be used, I do think that we need to, we may need to do some reconciliation with the specifications in the back end, but it sounds like the measure will be used for based on 3 years of data. So that should be, I think, the focus of the discussion at this point, it sounds like.
Can I just clarify, the 3 years is not simulated data, it's 3 real years?
Hi, this is Craig at Corrigan. Yes, this is 3 years of full data. The split sample is what needs to be projected because you would require 6 years to do a split year for 3 years each, and so that's why we didn't resubmit that, because it's incredibly difficult to get 6 years of continuous data.
Yeah, got it. Okay, thanks.
So just to be fully clear, the reliability figures that are presented here are from testing on 3 years of data.
Correct. For the signal to noise that was submitted. Yeah.
They're not a simulation or a projection or modeling based upon using 1 year of data to try to simulate 3 years of data.
Exactly right. The 0.81 and the 0.84 values are from real data.
So I'm looking at them. I'm looking at the measure. I think I look at the measure testing form. Okay. Sorry. Never mind. Go ahead. The actual measure testing form, and it says in section, I got to find it again. Sorry. Section 2A2.3, the median facility level reliability score, parentheses, projected for 3 years of data, end parentheses. And then below it says, using a single year of data, 2017, the median reliability is 0.593. So how am I I'm getting confused and I need help.
No, Susan, that's exactly the same phrase that I put in my comment too under question 7.
Yeah.
And I still haven't heard that explanation either as to why. That is a direct pull from the submission form that implies that the 3 years of data was a derived result. And see, I think that's what's causing a lot of the confusion.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Craig at CORE again. I'm wondering if that's a typo. We will do some quick back-end work here just to confirm that. This may be from leftover from the prior submission. So hold while we check that.
And this, Ron, we have seen that happen before, so it's possible. But Susan's right. It's exactly in section 2A23 of the submission form.
It's page 7 of the testing form.
Great. We'll look at that. I'm sorry about that confusion. This is the second submission form, and we'll fix it. So I don't know if you want to move on. And Craig, is that something you can look at in real time?
Yes, we're gonna try digging into that right now and get back to you shortly.
Okay. So this is Ashley. I just want to clarify. So I know verbally you're telling us that the data has not been projected. Are you pretty confident in that? Should we? Is it that you think that the submission form needs to be edited, or is there a possibility that it is actually projected? I just want to make sure, like, what Craig is checking on, is it checking on that it's a typo or checking on whether or not the data actually was projected or not? I just want to make sure.
I am checking on the typo, and okay. We did run these for the rulemaking process, so we're just confirming that it is a typo carryover.
Okay. Okay. Why don't we do this? So let me just jump to validity really quickly, and then before we have you guys submit your votes, we'll just check in with Craig again on the reliability and see whether or not there's any further discussion that needs to happen, if that's okay with folks. Okay. So for validity, so for this round of the review, we had 0 high, 4 moderate, 1 low, and 1 insufficient. So that essentially put us at a moderate rating for this sub-criterion. So a couple things that I wanted to point out. This is a maintenance measure. And so technically our rules, our requirements for maintenance measures is that by the time the measure comes back for maintenance review, that there has to be some empirical analysis to demonstrate validity. So initially they had done face validity, which was deemed to be acceptable. And because there was a challenge in demonstrating empirical validity in an effort to find other measures to correlate with for kind of a construct validity assessment, the developer submitted a rationale in their submission for why they were having difficulty being able to demonstrate that empirically. The demonstration of empirical validity is a requirement, but we do allow the submission of a rationale if they're unable to meet that requirement. And so the question then becomes, is that rationale satisfactory for the reviewers? So based on how the ratings were submitted for this criterion, it is reflected in that as you reviewed this, that rationale was acceptable. Generally, when a criteria has been voted on by the methods panel, we do not kind of rehash it, but we wanted to make sure that was clear to folks in their voting to see if there wasn't any clarity, whether or not we need to have a discussion about that and determine whether or not there was any questions about that particular rationale. I will also note that in the previous evaluation of this measure in last cycle for the methods panel, this actually was the sticking point as opposed to the reliability. So again, I mentioned things had kind of flipped between the two cycles. So again, we just wanted to bring your attention to that and to see whether or not there was any, you guys felt like there was any need to discuss, or are you settled and you're okay with the rationale?
So this is Susan. I brought up the point that there are some other similar measures that they could use for external validity. So I did have an issue with their statement that it couldn't be done. They could have used any of the 7-day hospital visits after surgery performed at ACS. It should be correlated. It should be directionally correct or directionally aligned. So I was kind of surprised that that was the rationale for not having some sort of something beyond face validity.
It's Elizabeth. Can I make one quick comment? It's just the ambulatory surgery center setting in particular, these are unique. These tend to be specialty specific facilities. So we actually just didn't feel comfortable saying that these could even. They're just completely different. You know, sometimes they're usually physician owned, so they're owned by a group of gastroenterologists. So there's two gastroenterologists and three ophthalmologists. There's so little overlap that we didn't feel like going to a whole nother procedure group because the cohorts don't overlap at all. The groups of procedures don't overlap at all. A priori, it was just our impression that we wouldn't know what to do with the results, whether they were correlated or uncorrelated. We didn't really feel like a priori we could say they should be correlated.
This is Jack. I'm reasonably comfortable not having a correlation with another measure here. It seems to me what we're measuring is trying to get some implication of direct measure of an unplanned complication problem that requires a hospitalization. Among folks who may not have a lot of hospitalizations for other things. So I'm willing to buy that. I'm more concerned about given the nature of that this is an intended to capture unplanned readmissions because of complications, some lapse in the care, whether the specifications, in fact, do that. And as I read the report, there was actually this statement of concern among some of the TEP members that if you saw a result on the colonoscopy that would want you'd want to put a patient in a hospital to follow up on that. That's not unplanned in the sense of it's a complication, something that was unanticipated from in the treatment, something that didn't go quite right. And I didn't see any discussion of how that concern was dealt with in the specifications, either by saying it seems to be de minimis so we can ignore it, or we've dealt with it in the specifications by excluding cases that look like X or not counting cases that look like X. So from my perspective, I'm more concerned about not the lack of correlation with other measures, but with whether they got the specifications right.
Ashley, you just have to give me guidance, Elizabeth, on whether you want me to comment on these comments. I don't want to over.
Yeah. I wanted to just give if there are a couple others. Is there anyone else from the methods panel? Any other thoughts on this? And then Elizabeth, we'll have you give a rebuttal. Any other comments? Is there? Let me just ask this. Is there a need to rehash this, or do you feel like your votes reflected your understanding of them submitting the rationale for not having empirical validity testing? That's really the question. If you feel settled on that, there's no need to rehash it. That was really the question, is to make that clarification and make sure that was the common understanding. And then if that was the common understanding, then there's no need to to dive into that discussion. So while you guys are thinking about that, I don't know if silence is agreement or not, but Elizabeth, why don't you go ahead and add any additional commentary you think might be helpful?
Sure, thanks so much. So the issue of could a hospital visit be related to a quality event, be related to ongoing care, for example, for the patient. That was really central to the whole deliberations on our expert panel and public comment. And we do have specific exclusions in the measure that address that. For example, we don't include patients with inflammatory bowel disease or diverticulitis because it was unclear if they visited a hospital within 7 days. We didn't have an algorithm in claims data we could use to sort out. Was that because, you know, they had the reason they had the colonoscopy in the first place was diagnostic or evaluative, and then their condition just got worse? We did some data analysis around that, and we weren't confident that when we saw an admission from that group of patients that we were seeing an unplanned visit, even after we pulled out planned, you know, what we usually pull out for planned procedures. So that was intensely focused on by our expert panel, and we refined the measure along the lines deliberately, and in the end there was, you know, strong face validity support for the measure. So we discussed that in the application. I'm not sure exactly which page it's on, but that helps provide a little bit of context on the clinical approach to ensuring the measure has that face validity.
And this is Ron. I just want to clarify something you said earlier. Face validity in this particular circumstance is good enough, right?
No,
Were you referring to me, Ron? Who was that directed to?
Who's that directed to, Ron?
Hi, Ron.
Ashley, can you restate, because my understanding of what you said before was that we need to try to do external validation, empiric validation, but it's not required for reendorsement, and that face validity is still relevant here, I assume.
It is still relevant. It is required essentially unless there's a rationale to demonstrate why it cannot be done. So that's really the question of whether or not the rationale is acceptable. Yes.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
So the question is whether we're comfortable is on the table. I guess it's important for the folks who felt if this was low and insufficient on validity, whether they have remaining concerns, right? Isn't that sort of?
Not necessarily. I mean, even with those folks staying where they are, the measure still would be at a moderate. And so I think it was more for the folks who voted moderate. Was that your understanding of what you were evaluating, the rationale for not submitting empirical evaluation versus having face validity?
This is Ron. I was moderate, and yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Jen as well.
Okay. Okay. So it would be helpful to hear from others who voted moderate just to make sure that we're, you know, kind of crossing our T's and dotting our I's. But it sounds like from the folks, from the discussion so far, that folks were okay with the rationale, no need to rehash that issue, and then we can circle back to reliability and then hopefully vote and close on this discussion. Is that acceptable to folks? So if you could just say like yay or nay to let me know, we're settled with the validity?
Yes. This is Karen.
Okay.
I am.
Yes,
Ron.
Christy. I'm good. I was moderate. I'm fine.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. Okay. So, Craig, I don't know if you're still there, but if you could give us an update on reliability and to just refresh from the session we had about 5 minutes ago, we were wanting to verify that the data the 3-year data sample that was tested was, in fact, 3 years of actual data and not projected or simulated data, and that the evaluation for reliability when the committee or when the panel votes shortly should be based on that 3 years of data, and their kind of feelings about whether or not that that approach and the way the testing was done and the results for that particular data sample was appropriate, correct?
Yes, yes. Thank you. Yeah, I did have a chance to look at the results, and it does look like it was a typo that we carried over the same section from last time. The results are publicly available right now in the rule, and so I'm going to read them out loud for you for the 3 years of data. For ASCs, the reliability was 0.87, so pretty close to the projected data. And then for HOPDs, it was 0.75, which is, again, fairly close to the projected data. And so that's in the real data and available in the final rule that we can send to you guys after this meeting. So, again, apologize for the failure to update the testing plan properly there. I myself was confused when it said projected because I knew that this was already released in the final rule. So apologies for that.
Craig, this is Ashley. Can you repeat that one more time? I didn't get a chance to write it down. Sorry.
Sure. Do you want the reliability results?
Yes, please.
Yes.
For the
it is.
Years.
For 3 years of data, in the final rule for ASCs is 0.87. And for HOPDs, it is 0.75.
Okay. So those are the numbers that the panel should really be basing their evaluation on?
Yes.
Okay. So, a couple things here. I would like to go ahead and close this discussion out so we can move on to the next set of measures. A couple of just clarifying points here. One, regardless of how the panel votes, we're going to need some update. We'll have to work with Yale to get some updates to your submission form before it moves forward, just so we're not kind of perpetuating confusion. to the extent that we can make sure that the specifications match, the measurement period kind of matches the testing that was performed and that three-year issue is resolved. For our voting today, I want to make sure that the panel is clear that the direction now is to have you guys vote on your evaluation of the reliability testing for based on 3 years of data at the ASC level, which was 0.87, and for the HOPDs, which was 0.75. Is there any other discussion that you'd like to have on that before you vote? Okay. Doesn't sound like it. So what I will do, what I will ask then is May sent an email out yesterday with the link to the SurveyMonkey. So we will ask that you kind of locate that survey and open it up and submit your votes only for reliability for this measure, please. And we will make sure that that gets submitted. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and move on to the next set of measures, the cost measures, and kind of shift gears here a little bit. I did want to just make a few comments, actually very similar to the discussion or the points that Ron raised earlier on. These measures are structured or constructed very similarly, but for different clinical areas. There's going to be a lot of overarching themes that will be applicable to many or all of these measures around reliability, around risk adjustment, some of the exclusions and so forth, and even with validity. So kind of keeping those things in mind, I wanted to just point you to the last few pages of your discussion guide. Jen so graciously sent us a table that she had created for her own purposes, and we kind of have reshared her work here at the end. And basically what she did is created a table so you could kind of see all of the measures together and where there were kind of similarities and differences across a few different aspects of the measures. And so I would just encourage you kind of as we make our way through, take a look at that. You could use it as guidance for some of the key testing results in terms of case size and so forth. I will point out that the rows that have grayed out are the measures that we will not be discussing. So you can focus on the three that within that table that will be the focus of discussion. At the top, she did also kind of pull out some of the kind of overarching methodologies that kind of cross the all eight of the measures that will also hopefully be helpful in some of this discussion. I wanted to just also
This is on pages 24 to 26 of the discussion guide.
Yes, it starts on page 24.
Great, thank you.
Sorry, thank you for pointing that out, Jack. So I did also just want to kind of, as a point of process, that we can be consistent across. So, when we make a decision about, a particular threshold that we're comfortable with reliability, for example, that we are consistent with that, I will do my best to point those points of discussion out and make sure that we're carrying those across all of the measures and where possible, maybe we can even find some efficiencies with getting through these three measures. So thank you very much, Jen, for that. We appreciate that. And let's go ahead and dive in. So we're going to go to 3508, which is the PCI outpatient, elective outpatient PCI. Sorry, I'm just kind of organizing my papers here. So, again, I won't rehash all of the specs, but this is a cost measure. It's a new measure. It's an episode-based cost measure specified at the clinician and clinician group or practice level. I think what I'm going to do is kind of refer to some of Jen's summary comments at the top about how these measures are constructed, and then we can maybe dive into 3508. Does that work for folks? Again, just if there are other suggestions on how best to do that, I'm certainly open to that, but maybe that's a good place to start. Does that work for folks?
Yes.
Okay. These measures basically are episode-based cost measures that use CPT and HCPCS codes from Part B claims that trigger an acute condition or procedure episode. Services are assigned from both Part A and Part B claims using a hierarchical set of assignment rules. Most of the episodes are 30 days long, but that may vary by the clinical condition. And some of the subcategories, like, for example, the revascularization measure uses subcategories or strata to categorize various groups of folks within the clinical population. And so the cost measure ends up being the sum of the ratio of the observed to expected payment standardized cost for all the cases that are attributed at the 10 level, which basically is the kind of the group level, or the 10 MPI, which would be the clinician level. That sum is then multiplied by the national average observed cost to generate a dollar amount. Okay. So I think maybe instead, so trigger rules, basically procedure episodes are triggered by the presence of a relevant service code on a provider bill. Cases are limited to the relevant DRG, so they're trying to assign claims to the episode that are specific to that particular clinical condition and the activities of the clinician. And the pneumonia episode is slightly different in that the episode is triggered by the presence of a pneumonia DRG on the Part B provider bill. I'm going to skip down just a little bit here to risk adjustment. So the risk model is based on the HEC model with a 120-day look-back period. And there are also some patient demographic factors that are addressed, like age or disability without ESRD. Most, in terms of how they handle outliers, allowed amounts are winterized at the 0.5th percentile and then renormalized by multiplying each episode's winterized expected cost by the subgroup's average expected cost. And then once the outliers are excluded, then the distribution is again renormalized. So, again, just a high-level overview of some of the kind of underpinnings of the construction of the measures. And, again, I'm going to hop back up to 3508, and we will
Maybe just to pause for a second while you're reorienting. Any colleague should correct anything I said that may have been in wrong, not correct in that summary. I did it, you know, kind of quickly across the set. So if I got anything factually incorrect, please, you know, don't hesitate. For example, I'm looking at this now, not remembering whether 30 days was most of them or not. But again, there were a lot of them, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, and any clarifications from colleagues are appreciated.
Thanks, Jen. Well, we can sort out some of that with the individual review.
Okay,
we'll dive into
that
one individually too. So, yeah, I just wanted to provide a high level. So with the PCI measure, it is looking at evaluating clinicians' risk-adjusted costs for Medicare beneficiaries who receive an elective PCI in an outpatient basis. The cost measure score is the clinician's average risk-adjusted cost for the episode group, average across all the episodes attributed to the clinician. Again, the risk adjustment uses higher HCCs. There was no social factors included in the risk adjustment based on the empirical analysis that they completed. And I will just jump down to reliability now. This was a sub-criterion where there was consensus not reached. We had zero high, three moderate, three low, and zero insufficient. So we had a split right down the middle. I wonder, okay, so we had both measure score and information on data element reliability submitted. However, the information submitted for data element reliability doesn't meet NQF criteria for demonstrating reliability to the data element. So the analysis and voting for this criteria should be focused on the other empirical analysis that was submitted around the signal to noise and the test retest and so forth. So for the measure score reliability, again, they did test retest with correlations and signal to noise. They conducted it using two sets of episodes, assessing the correlation and quintile rank stability between the 10 or the 10 NPI cost scores, and then that were calculated from both of the samples, and then they ranked clinicians by their score within each sample into quintiles, and then calculate the percentage of clinicians who change in the measure score quintile between the two samples. So
with the signal-to-noise analysis, they had a mean reliability of 0.726 at the 10 level and 0.531 at the 10 MPI level. For the test-retest Pearson correlation, they had a score of 0.48 at the 10 level and 0.42 at the 10 MPI level. And the concerns were largely around the low reliability scores, particularly at the 10 MPI level, and the low Pearson correlation score. There was also some issues around the specifications and whether or not they were clear or specific enough in order to kind of recreate this measure. And also some concerns around whether the measure is actually recognizing costs for only one provider versus the whole clinical care team, and also how $0 claims are handled was not clear in the specification. So with that, I'm going to open it up to the panel for discussion. We do also have the developers from Acumen who are on the phone. And so as questions arise, we will make sure that they have an opportunity to respond.
So this is Ron. I have a question that perhaps is at least my difference between moderate and low. So I think you gave the exact numbers that we all had and are in the analyses that we did, our ratings that we gave. So is there formal definitions of what the means need to be for signal to noise and the test retest Pearson correlation score so that we can differentiate between moderate and low? Because was the testing done? Absolutely. Are the results exactly as you said? Absolutely. The tough part from an analytic perspective, at least for me, was if the results were adequate or not, and whether we had backing to say that. So that's the first question I'd like to ask.
Right.
And this,
Ron,
is,
this is
Jack. Sorry, I was on mute. Sorry. I was talking. I just wanted to say real quick that NQS does not provide any thresholds for reliability. You know, there's varying sources of literature that suggest certain cutoffs, but we don't necessarily have any specific guidance on that, and that's why we have convened you guys. I think there just needs to be some agreement about your comfort level for certain levels of scores.
Thank you for confirming what I believed was true, but did not know if I didn't know something that everybody else knew. It is somewhat subjective. Okay, thank you.
And this is Sri Nagavarapu from Acumen. I just wanted to note very quickly that we have reliability numbers for higher case minimums as well that could be relevant to the discussion. We're happy to walk through those. Those reliability numbers are substantially higher at higher case minimums, and my understanding is that CMS would consider higher case minimums for any of these measures. We presented one case minimum in the initial submission, but are happy to present the results at other case minima, which look substantially higher even than the one at 10.
So this is
Hi, this is Jack Needleman. I meant to get myself off mute and managed to shut my phone down and get off the call, and I'm back. Where are we in the discussion? Because I'm ready to wade in here.
Go ahead and jump in, Jack. This is Ashley. We're still just talking about the signal-to-noise analysis and the test-retest analysis.
Terrific. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is I want to thank the developers here because this is the partly there's a well-established, having sat on the cost committee for a while, this is a well-established set of methodologies. They're well-described. The variations from measure to measure are usually well-described, although the attribution, particularly in the multi-member attribution, is always a little fuzzy. The risk assessment model is relatively standard with, and they've indicated where they've added some measure-specific stuff or stratified. So I'm very happy with the way in which this information is presented. And one of the reasons why I'm happy about the way this information is presented is the way in which they presented the reliability data. They've given us something we haven't seen in other measures before, which is we see the reliability measure as a signal to noise, we see it as a test retest, and we see in the quintile analysis the sense of how stable the rankings are of individuals within these distributions, which can be roughly correlated with some sense of the Pearson correlation and the reliability. Ron was absolutely right. We don't have standards for where we are, so each of us is sort of applying our own standards. And I would love for the steering committee to find some time, not steering committee, the full committee to find some time to actually discuss, given results like this, where we can see the impacts, what the standards ought to be. I think the literature-based classifications are wrong. And 0.4 on a Pearson correlation is simply too low to be confident that from sample to sample, individuals are being consistently and accurately ranked. And that was my reaction to this one. If you go back to the original Adams paper that was published on signal to noise, he says that a 0.7 reliability level in a simple split of low, not low, 20% of the folks get misclassified. It was 20 or 25%. It's been a while since I looked at the paper. But that's a not small number. But it may be a number we're prepared to live with as saying we're not going to get it perfect. Everybody's not going to wind up being ranked the same way. But I start feeling very uncomfortable when I see a lot higher than 20%. The test retest here is very low. My vague recollection, again, from some piece of literature says test retest less than 0.8 is probably not appropriate for individual ranking or individual assessment, and that's the way these measures are being used. And then I look at the quintiles stuff, that's the piece that's often been missing to me. That's the real practical, how stable are the rankings? And in the MIPS thing, you get put into a decile, and the number of points you get depends upon where in that decile you are. So if you move 4 deciles or 3 deciles or 2 deciles, if you move 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 deciles down the distribution because of the sample that we wind up with, you've just lost half you've either gained or lost half of the points you're going to get for this measure. That feels to me too much. So when I look at quintile rankings, which say only 40% of the folks stay in the top quintile, which means within, the two, and a third of the sample is moved down to the bottom 3 quintiles, that does not feel stable enough to me to endorse as a reliable measure. And that's why I voted low on this.
This is Jen. I couldn't agree more. And the one addition I would make on the test retest, this is no variation in the timing of the data. So it's one big piece of data, with 2 random samples pulled. There is, to me, also risk of changes in coding practices, all kinds of coding things that happen over time. And so to me, this would be an upper estimate, because of all of the subtle sort of issues with claims over time. So that bothered me as well.
This is Christy Coghlan. I just want to weigh in, and I totally agree with Jack as well. I think the movement across the quintiles, you know, you could have a score of 95 one period or one sample, and then a score of 65. I mean, that's probably, if you were looking at some rating system, you know, a 5-star compared to a 3-star, 2-star. I don't know what, you know, it could be a huge difference in where you might rank, and that's exactly what we don't want to see.
So again, in our advisory role to the TAPs and the steering committees. Thank you, Jack, for that explanation. I think even though you didn't formulate a rule, you certainly explained a rationale for a potential rule. I think that's exactly what the kinds of things, and I probably would consider changing my score to low with kind of a synopsis of exactly what Jack said. We need to convey to the TAPs that while there are not formal definitions for moderate and low reliability, the concerns we have when the reliability scores start to hit these sorts of numbers, that the reliability of the measure is under a serious threat. And how we do that is not necessarily so much a matter of which box we put it in, low or moderate, although that's the only mechanism we have available, as the overall message that's communicated that there was a great deal of discussion in the committee about the reliability scores that were presented and a great concern over whether this measure would be applicable across different sizes, different groups, different times, all the things you just heard. I'm okay with that.
This is Sri Nagavarapu from Acumen. I was hoping I could address some of the comments that have come up so far.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
So the first thing I wanted to mention is that, as I noted, the reliability results that we presented for the outpatient PCI measure were using a case minimum of 10 episodes, just because in the past this measure had been considered at 10 episodes. But this is a choice that CMS will make down the road, and so the reliability is substantially higher at different case minima. So if you move to 20 episodes for the 10 version of the measure, the mean reliability is 0.802. If you move to 30 episodes, it's 0.841. And then 40 episodes is even higher at 0.87. Similarly, for 10 NPIs, you get very sharp increases in reliability at different case minima. When you move from 10 to 20, you move up to mean reliability of 0.65. Going to 30 is at 0.72. And then going to 40 is at 0.77. And at that point, even the minimum reliability is 0.701, above the typical threshold for high reliability. In regards to the comparison between those reliability numbers and the Pearson correlations for test retest, the one thing I would want to caution people on is that all of these are done with a 10-episode case minimum. And so because we are using 1 year of data for the test retest and we do a random sample, we're looking only at the set of providers with 20 episodes or more and ensuring that they have at least 10 in each sample. Now that's something because of the sharp increases in reliability that I just mentioned, that Pearson correlation is very likely to change if we use a different case threshold than 10 in order to do the correlations across the test retest. The quintile rank stability is also very likely to change based on the case minima for that reason. And so for that reason, the Pearson correlations here should in fact be thought of as a lower estimate, a lower bound estimate of what the correlations are, because we're starting from an extremely low case minimum. The final point I just wanted to make was about the overall process of risk adjustment. If it's helpful, what we can do is for the summary that was given for all of the measures, provide sort of feedback and review the summary of the measures to correct anything there. There were some points made about risk adjustment where I just want to emphasize that the risk adjustment models do incorporate measure-specific risk adjusters that were suggested by the specialty society representatives that we worked with closely at each step of the way to construct the measures. So the episode windows they vary. For the measures you're considering here, they vary anywhere from 30 to 90 days. For other measures, they could be shorter. Those were clinical determinations made by the specialty society representatives, as were the addition of other risk adjusters. But I'll stop there, but I just wanted to make sure that the numbers on reliability were considered, because I know you haven't had a chance to see what they would look like at higher case minimum, and they look substantially higher.
So this is Susan, just a point of clarification, just so I understand the rules here. So the measure developer submitted the statistics for 10, and that's the measure that's the conditions under which we're assessing the measure. Is it okay we haven't seen the numbers. They're going to be higher. I mean, mathematically, they ought to be higher. So what are we supposed to do with that information, I guess, is my question.
Yes, that's correct. This is Ashley from NQS. So generally, we do not allow, at this point in the process, developers to provide additional information. So to the extent that they would be adding in new testing data, the methods panel should be voting on what's in front of them at this point, and we can work with the developers on how to fix the submission or provide additional reliability results potentially in another submission.
Okay. Actually, this is Jack. Just real quick, in terms of specifications, is the minimum number of cases part of the specification?
Yes, I believe it's 10 as well, but we can clarify that right now. Tree?
Yep, our understanding is that in past NQF submissions that we've seen, that the case minimum isn't part of the submission. This is a CMS decision, but I know that they're not wedded to a 10 case minimum on these episode based measures, and there's always a discussion of the trade-offs between reliability and submission coverage in order to make that decision about a case minimum, and these sorts of numbers that I'm giving to you, which actually we could send you right now or at the end of the day, as ever you prefer, those would go into determining what the case minimum would be at CMS.
Yeah, the case minimum, this is Ashley, the case minimum, is very similar to the discussion that we had with the last measure. I mean, we're really kind of toting the line here in terms of changing the application, which should not be changes, fixing a typo, maybe one thing, but then, adding information to the submission at this point generally is not part of the process. Is we don't really have time for folks to be able to reassess new information and still be able to, kind of stick to the flow of the process. So I think sharing that information is helpful, but I think at this point for where we are on the call, we need to have folks, vote on what's in front of them. The case minimum is, technically part of the specifications because again, like we said earlier, the testing of the measure also is representative of the threshold of how the measure can be used. So it is technically part of the specification. So I'll just stop there.
Yeah, and I just wanted to. I think someone on our team mentioned that maybe the connection wasn't clear, but I just want to make clear that CMS would. And my understanding is that CMS would be willing to consider higher case minimums in order to consider the reliability trade-off. I just wasn't sure the connection was clear before. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Ashley, I was just struck by your language. Technically, the case minimum is part of the specification, but I would go one step further, given that what we know, what just got explicitly said, what got documented in some of the numbers, is reliability is very much a measure of at the individual level, is very much a matter of the caseload and the size of the number of cases. So we can only consider making a judgment of reliability at a specific level of sampling or cases. This is one of those cases where there's a real difference between us and CMS. CMS needs to be CMS has to worry about coverage. If we make cases so high, we've got four people in the country covered by the measure. From their perspective, that's not useful. So they've got to think about the reliability. They may be thinking in one way about reliability, case, the number of folks covered, trade-offs. From our perspective, though, there's a minimum reliability threshold we need to be comfortable with. And that trade-off is different in the calculation of CMS than it is for us. The trade-off with how many people the measure will actually affect is irrelevant to the judgment of does the measure meet the minimum level of reliability we're comfortable with.
So are there other comments from METHIS panel members on this particular issue? And do you feel ready to vote on reliability at this point for this measure?
I am. It's Ron.
Yes, no from others?
Susan, I am.
Yes. Karen, me too.
Yep. Christy, yes.
Okay.
I am.
Okay.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Thank you, everyone. It's hard on the phone to gauge where folks are. So I'm going to go ahead and ask you to submit your votes for reliability via the SurveyMonkey link. The ratings for validity were moderate, but I did just want to raise one question for the committee on moderate on the validity criterion, which would be applicable to all of the measures. The face validity assessment that was submitted does not meet NQF requirements, but we do require a systematic assessment of face validity, so there has to be some description of a process where an external group, a group external to the measure development process was asked a question or series of questions about the ability of the measure or the validity of the measure. Either via scoring or a survey or some sort. And so their description of face validity does not meet that threshold. They did submit empirical validity testing for each of the measures. And so for this particular measure, as the case, I just want to make sure that folks voting were voting not necessarily a moderate based on accepting the face validity, but that the empirical validity testing actually, that your assessment of the empirical validity testing actually was acceptable. And in this case, they did construct validity with indicators of that were shown, were identified based on being indicators of resource utilization, which were around hospital admissions and post-acute care, and this was similar to how they constructed their empirical analysis of validity for across all their measures, but for this particular measure, they used a mean observed expected cost ratios for various indicators around whether or not there was a hospital admission or whether or not there was a PAC post-acute care service usage.
And this is Sri from Acumen. On Face Validity Day, I was wondering if I could just make one comment to describe the process that we sort of walked through in the testing.
Sure.
So essentially, we have a comprehensive process of collaborative relationships with specialty societies that are relevant to each of these measures. We go through a recruiting process where a large group of specialty society members decides which episode-based measure to create, and they vote based on thresholds. We then move to building each measure in detail with clinical work groups that are pulled from those specialty society representatives. They vote at each stage of the way on measure specifications on each aspect, so trigger codes that define the measures, the risk adjusters, the exclusions, what costs are counted. Typically, we use a 60% threshold to have a formal voting process so that we can document what the decisions were made by the work group. After that, we went through a field testing period for a month where we released reports to clinicians nationally. To my knowledge, it's the largest field testing effort that CMS has had for any measures. This year, there are about 800,000 reports released to all attributed clinicians naturally across all measures. And based on the feedback from that field testing period, we go back to the clinical work groups from the specialty societies and walk through the comments that we got in field testing. They look at measure specifications and make changes and then vote on changes to measure specifications. So I just wanted to, I know that we walked through the clinical subcommittee and the work group process in the case validity section of the testing form, and I wanted to make sure that it was clear that's a formal process with voting at each step of the way on measure specifications in sort of comprehensive engagement with the specialty societies directly.
Right, so I think the clarifying point is, there's a couple of things with that is, voting as a part of the measure development process, as opposed to some external assessment of the measure's validity, I think is kind of what the distinction would be. And so maybe if you could clarify those voting, was that part of the development process? And so the people who were voting were also helping to establish specifications and the kind of structure of the measure?
Yep. The work groups were those who were structuring they worked on developing the measure specifications. The voting process, though, I would describe as an external input process in the sense that all of these work group members were nominated by specialty societies to join this, and the work group members have the opportunity to discuss measure specifications with their specialty societies both before and after field testing. And so the way that the process is set up is as a way of getting external validation of the measures that at each step of the way, just leveraging the fact that the work members and the subcommittee members have the ability to see the details of the data and be able to communicate the questions to specialty societies and other stakeholders they're affiliated with or representing.
Okay. And I don't want to belabor this too much, but I think the other piece that we would be missing for that in order for us to, at NQF, to kind of consider that face validity is there we have to have some understanding of how it was systematically assessed. So was everyone kind of asked the same question or set of questions about the validity of the measure at a certain point in the process, kind of external evaluators of the measure to say, did they could give some sort of kind of systematic assessment either by ranking or voting or scoring, so that those results could then be, you know, collated and evaluated based on the percent of folks that scored, you know, that they strongly agreed that, you know, the measure was valid or what have you. So I think, you know, again, when we say systematic assessment of face validity, we're looking for not just that, you know, folks were able to get feedback, but, you know, what was the kind of structure around them saying that this was, you know, a valid indicator of quality, that the measure is doing what it's intended to do. So I'll just leave it at that and see if other methods panel members have anything to add to that.
No.
And there's votes after field testing to clarify to ensure that people were satisfied with the method specifications and based on the external input that was given through field testing, especially society. So I just want to make sure.
But those votes were not included in the submission, correct?
Those votes aren't in the testing submission. The votes were taken along throughout the process as well as after field testing on every aspect of the measure, but that they weren't included in the testing submission form.
Right. Okay. I think that's cool. Helpful, and I do think it's probably not quite there based on our requirements. So, I think that it sounds like you guys might have done something like that, but maybe it's not quite communicated in the form in the way that we need to kind of have it reflected in order to have it kind of meet that standard. You know, I think the question is really then around the methods panel's evaluation of the empirical analysis that was submitted. I did want to just give them an opportunity to reflect on that and see whether or not there were any concerns with that. And if there aren't any concerns, then we don't need to rehash validity again. I just wanted to kind of make that distinction and just make sure that folks have an understanding and that the votes were kind of based on the same assumptions.
This is Jen. I absolutely did not pick up on that sort of face validity distinction. And so, no, my ranking absolutely considered face validity. So, anyway, I just wanted to – this has been a clarifying conversation for me. The other question I would ask of my colleagues, I think someone pointed out earlier that there's a pattern across all of these measures, and this sort of hypothesis testing around, you know, who should cost more. It's interesting how the statistics behave depending on the measure. This one looks somewhat well-behaved, where the sort of residual group is close to 1, and the high-cost group has a ratio of 1.48 or 1.07. Some of them, the variable that they select to split the group on almost looks like a perfect predictor of the score. And so this, you know, the behavior of the statistic was curious to me, and I don't know, I was curious what my more statistically trained colleagues would have to say about this. But is that okay to ask a question like that? I'm sorry if that's not the right, it's not the right venue.
No, I think that's fine, Jen.
Okay.
Okay, so this is Jack. Those are useful, and yeah, because in some cases what they've done is they've picked the problem. In some sense, it's a given. We know on some of the cost measures where everything is standardized pricing, once you've included the DRG and its standardized price in sort of the base cost adjustment, all the additional costs, the variations in costs,
come from the post-acute care, heavily influenced by institutional care, and readmission. So it should be that if you've got a readmission, the cost associated with that readmission is going to be higher than is going to be what's driving a ratio higher than expected, since the readmissions are not predicted, aren't fully predicted by the risk adjustment. If the readmissions were fully predicted by the risk adjustment, then we'd have no basis for unplanned readmission here or unexpected readmission. Some patients are just going to get readmitted, but given that the risk adjuster in this one is virtually doing no work at all,
right?
But in others is doing predicting 25% of the variance or 50% of the variance. I think it's a given that if readmissions are the things that drive up the cost and we haven't fully predicted readmissions, we're going to see a higher than expected readmission number. That's what should be happening. All it's saying is our excess costs, our higher than expected costs, are coming from the readmission or coming from the SNF care. A substantial portion of them are. So, yeah, it's just confirming what we know from the construction of the measure.
Exactly. So to me, that analysis didn't really comment much on validity. It was really just sort of demonstrating how the measure works. And therefore, my rating was primarily face validity, which is now off the table. So I'm a little bit of a loss, at a loss. But
in terms of complementary analyses for empirical validity, other items that we've looked at and can provide upon request, look at various types of kind of themes or categories of clinical outcomes beyond readmissions in post-acute care. My colleague Alex Sandu, who's a cardiologist here, can walk through some of those categories for that patient PCI measure very quickly.
Thank you, everybody. So with outpatient PCI, we divided the cost into multiple themes, including the cost of the initial PCI, the cost of a recurrent PCI after that initial PCI, the cost of bleeding complications, the cost of other complications unrelated to bleeding, and the cost of other admissions. And to not necessarily go into the details, as we expect, the higher costs related to the initial PCI were significantly higher in higher cost quintile providers, so the providers with higher cost scores had higher costs there, which as is been discussed was expected, but what we also saw was that those providers had higher costs when it came to recurrent MI or recurrent PCI after the initial one, which again would be a sign that these different aspects of quality were likely correlated, and similarly were more likely to have higher costs when it came to bleeding complications as well. So I think that there's some correlation across these different clinical themes that we know are related to kind of the quality of care and the efficiency of care provided.
I happen to think it's nearly impossible to validate claims-based costs with claims. I think a real validation test requires external data, right? Otherwise, I mean, you can propose hypotheses and test them, and I guess that gets you a certain distance down the road. But again, from an overarching methodological perspective, it's just very challenging because you're using the same data that the measure is based on to validate it. So I appreciate that. I like the clinical thinking. That helps a lot, but just a bigger point.
So we're at about 12 minutes to the hour, and I just wanted to kind of do a pulse check here. Are there others besides Jen who their initial rating for validity was based on face validity? Yes, no.
Yes, mine were too, Christy. I didn't realize that.
Okay. There's also kind of a high vote here, so it's hard to tell because even with face validity, moderate would be the highest vote that you could submit based on the way that the criteria is set up. So I'd like to suggest, if folks are okay with it, that we do another vote for validity, unless there's other discussions that you'd like to have based on the empirical analysis that's here. Does that resonate with folks?
Sure.
Are you ready to vote?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's have you go ahead and submit your vote on validity for this measure, and you should be able to submit that. So there will be two votes for this measure, one on reliability and one on validity. Now that that's done, okay, we have 10 minutes left, and I think what would be useful at this point is to just have a discussion about how to address or how we should approach the evaluation of the remaining measures. So we do have a second call that is scheduled on next Tuesday, which would be a continuation of this call. What are your feelings about of kind of evaluating the remainder of the measures that are currently slated for discussion? Are there particular kind of sticking points that you think might be applicable to all of those that we might maybe restructure that discussion on the next call in a different way? Are you okay with us just continuing to go through measure by measure and have that discussion? Jen did mention that, you know, some of the measures do kind of behave a little bit differently based on kind of the clinical population and the data of the data set. So I just want to kind of get a sense from folks on what your leaning is towards.
Sorry for the quiet. I'm just reading down ahead to the ones that are still here.
Yeah. So we have the colonoscopy, surveillance, screening measure, and the knee arthroplasty measure.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of the remaining ones sort of had it's interesting how this all fell out. Right. They have points of kind of some of the empirical concerns that we've talked about are they're right in the middle of being stronger than the weak ones, but they each kind of have their own features.
Okay. Why don't we do this then? We will just pick up on the next call and jump into the last two measures. And at that point also, we will offer the opportunity again on whether you'd like to pull additional measures for discussion or whether you think any of these overarching issues would impact any of the other measures. So I don't think it's worth kind of diving in the next 7 minutes unless you guys would like to do so. I think we'll still have to carry over into the next call, and it seems like it'd be easier to kind of start fresh with a new measure if folks are okay with that.
On a Friday afternoon, for sure.
I'm okay with dealing with the last two on the next call. I'll be in China when we do this, so it's going to be 10 o'clock at night. Let's see if we can get it done a little bit faster.
That's wrong. I agree.
Wow. I do want to, since we, I do want to just provide some additional feedback to Acumen. And again, I have been very appreciative of both the level of documentation and the thoughtfulness with which the measures are constructed, and the discussion of the expert panel process was reaffirming of that. The one comment I would make is somebody trying to assess reliability and better understanding your expert panel thing is, and I understand why you're not reporting each individual vote of the group. Did they hit the 60% threshold? How high it was? That's going to be an awful lot of votes to report, and the sort of general standard sounds reasonable. But as I read that description and I heard you describe it, I'm not super comfortable with the somewhat in agreement category being included within 60%. That's a very weak endorsement level. So it's your process, but I would feel more comfortable if the scale was a little bit different and there was a stronger level of endorsement and not the, I'm okay with it, as being included within that 60%. So that's just some feedback. It's your process. We'll see whatever gets delivered.
This is Christy. I second that. I noted that in my comments as well. I don't think that should be included in, high reliability. Face validity.
Oh, could this is Sri from Acumen. Could I just clarify the I appreciate those comments. Could I just clarify what's meant by the somewhat in agreement point? Just to make sure, when we would take votes on particular aspects of the measures, there would be yes, no for, let's say, should this cohort be excluded, and locked in status for the stroke measure, for instance. And so those were yes, no votes, and so I just want to make sure I understood about the somewhat in.
So this is Ashley. I don't want to answer for Jack or the other Bethes panel member who had a concern about that, but for a demonstration of face validity, it wouldn't be on pieces of the measure. It would need to be a systematic assessment of the measure as a whole and whether or not it is measuring what you're intended to be measuring. So I think that's also kind of the distinction there with kind of taking votes throughout the process on pieces of the measure versus having an overall kind of objective assessment of the measure as a whole and how it's performing and what it's measuring as opposed to kind of, a particular specification or something like that. So I just want to clarify that in terms of, what we would potentially need in a future submission to demonstrate face validity. Hopefully that's clear. But I would kind of throw that back to Jack on his comment about this somewhat.
You caught it, Ashley.
Okay. Let's go ahead and log off. Thank you, everyone, for your time. We will reconvene next Tuesday, and we will pick up where we left off for the last two measures.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, everyone. Bye. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Ashley.